UK Wine Show, show number 208. Ryan Opez on wine blogging. Good morning, afternoon, or evening, or whichever one fits you as you relax and listen to this week's UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott, and this week we've got another packed show as usual. We're going to be talking with Ryan Opez, wine blogger and organiser of the European Wine Bloggers Conference. We're going to be talking to Ryan about wine blogging and social media. I actually ran into Ryan at the London International Wine Fair yesterday, although I recorded the show a couple of months ago. He was running an area known as the Access Zone at the show, and it was one of the many, many stands at London's International Wine Fair, the UK's premier wine trade event. In fact, I went there for all 3 days this year, which is pretty unheard of for me. I sometimes go for one or two, but this year I went for all three, and it was a good buzz. And while I think the numbers were down and a bit flat perhaps on maybe 2007, 2006, which were really big years, probably very similar to 2009, I think the year was, which was probably because of the volcano and obviously the old world economic situation. It was still a really, really good show for me. I managed to do a load of different podcasts. I recorded everything from a perfumer, a bulk shipper, talking to someone about Eastern European wines, and white dessert wine sometimes have that gingery feel on the back of the throat. So I recorded loads and loads of interesting shows, which will come out over the next few months. But this week, I've finally finished the book, What Price is Bordeaux? I read a lot of it on the hour and a half tube journey each way in there. So we'll review that in the show later on, as well as our usual mixture of news, quotes, and mystery producer. In fact, let's get into our mystery producer, and as usual, I'm going to give you a clue now, then I'm going to give you a clue before the interview and the answer at the end of the show. So, this week's mystery producer is a South African winery. It's a family business dating back to the beginning of the last century when the current proprietor, Michael Bax, father, who'd arrived in the Cape Town as a penniless political and religious refugee from Lithuania, and he was asked whether he wanted to buy a farm. However, it wasn't until Michael's father focused on the wine side of the business and opened the cellar doors to the public in 1970. Michael, a graduate of Stellenbosch University, now runs a 110-hectare vineyard with two additional satellite vineyards located along the slopes of Simonsberg Mountain, midway between Paarl and Stellenbosch, some 40 minutes from Cape Town. Winemaking is under the reins of Alicia Rackner, also a Stellenbosch University graduate who believes it should be done with as little intervention as possible. Well, we'll find out about wines made with little intervention on the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. It's good news for Tesco and Marks & Spencer's, who have topped the charts for supermarket own label wines in the 2010 International Wine Challenge, the results of which were revealed this week at the London International Wine Fair. Both Tesco and Marks & Spencer picked up 62 awards for their own label wines, with M&S bagging 5 golds. The runners-up were Sainsbury's with 59 awards, then Asda with 56 and Waitrose with 18. Gold medals also went to two English wines, that's Camel Valley Pinot Noir Rosé Bru and Knightimber Blanc de Blanc. But it was France who remained at the top of their game, with 947 medals and 75 golds. Australia was next with 602 medals and 65 golds.
That's pretty good news for Australia, who, after all, Bordeaux produces more wine than all of Australia, so not too bad for them. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, Obbins is to experiment with a range of natural wines in 10 stores and online as part of a push to increase its range of environmentally friendly wines. If successful, the lineup will expand from 8 wines and be rolled out to other stores. But you may ask, what is a natural wine? Well, natural wines made with as little chemical and technological intervention as possible, both in the vineyard and during the winemaking process. But there is some controversy surrounding natural wines, as many critics believe the term to be misleading. There's no established certification body, and the term has no legal status. Natural winemakers also differ in what they consider to be an acceptable level of intervention. Meanwhile, Obbins say they're offering the consumer something different, but accept these wines probably won't be a massive commercial movement, but are a step towards sustainable viticulture.
Well, another fragmentation. We have organic wines, biodynamic wines, sustainable viticulture, carbon zero, and now natural wines. All these others have certification bodies, so unless natural wines get certified, it's a bit like private bin or vintner selection. It's an absolutely meaningless term, and I'm surprised that Oddbins are making a big fuss about something so meaningless. Another term that's abused regularly is fine wine. But what do people think of the term fine wine, Jane?
Well, latest research by Wine Intelligence that was revealed at the Fine Wine 2010 conference shows that heritage and provenance of fine wines are by far the biggest motivators for consumers. Ethical credentials and scarcity were at the bottom of their considerations. Other factors that motivated consumers to buy fine wines were provenance associated with a region, handcrafted nature of production, critical acclaim, family-owned credentials, and rarity. And according to Wine Intelligence, there are 7 million consumers of luxury or super premium wines, accounting for 13% of total spend of wine in the UK. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to check out these stories at our website, 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. I can believe this fine wine is not about the quality of the wine, but the perceived heritage of the wine. Usually because those wines that claim to be fine wine tend to spend a lot of money trying to big up the snob value of their wines and be perceived as fine wines. Personally, I hate the term fine wine. It has such a snobby word to it. I normally associate fine wines with wines that are priced not by the quality, but by supply versus demand. For example, at the extreme fine wine Bordeaux end, wine has a closer relationship with the world economic situation than the quality of the product in any particular year. And we're going to find out more about wine pricing, particularly with regard to Bordeaux, in this week's Spotlight, because I'm reviewing the book, What Price Bordeaux, a book by Benjamin Llewellyn. He's a master of wines. Actually, why don't we get into that right now? So next up, we have the Spotlight, What Price Bordeaux by Benjamin Llewellyn, master of wines. If you've ever wondered why some Bordeaux wines achieve incredible prices, yet others are very cheap gluggers, then this book is for you. Benjamin Llewellyn looks at the history and the economics of Bordeaux and tries to understand how the price of Bordeaux is determined. After all, Bordeaux is the largest wine-producing region in France, with wines that range from awful to the absolutely sublime, and has a similar value proposition from the appalling value right through to very good value. But what price is right for wine? Certainly the Bordelais would have you believe that the market sets the price. But how is the market determined? This is the key question that Benjamin attempts to answer. Perhaps disappointingly, he doesn't actually say whether a price is sensible price or not, or even pass comment on what prices should be. Benjamin prefers to hide behind price and look like a good economist and assume that the price is the right price at the time. Sadly, economics assumes that the market has the perfect information. But with top Bordeaux wines, many purchasers are relying on incomplete information, or worse still, information supplied by the person selling the wines. And I'd prefer more insights along those lines. But this is a subjective area, and Benjamin tries to keep to safer, more researched information. At the very top end, Bordeaux is a luxury good, with a price that represents its basic supply and demand. At the bottom end, the quality is more important to setting price. In this book, Benjamin focuses his attention on the very top end of the market, and as such, the price is impossible to determine correctly. It's a bit like, how long is a piece of string? It's what it is. While Benjamin attempts this, he tries to give a background and an understanding of the current eye-watering Bordeaux prices for the first growths, and to a lesser extent, other Bordeaux wines. He explains the origins and the classifications, the price-setting process for on-premier wines, and the importance of critics, the difference between land and the brand, which he contrasts with Bordeaux, where the soils are less important than the marque, as in Burgundy, location is king. Benjamin uses a huge range of historical prices, neatly depicted in graphs to show the historical trends, the moments of overexuberance in the past where rather sharp and painful corrections have occurred, have happened all of a sudden and taken out many key players in the industry and consumers. In the end, I did enjoy this book, and it certainly gives fresh insight into Bordeaux that many other books simply don't cover. The strange thing for me about this book is it took me about a month to read, which is not a good sign. I should have been able to rattle through this book in a week. Some books I can't put down. This one I found hard to pick up. But I can't explain why. I like the book, I learned a lot from it, and I'm definitely going to use it as a reference book in future. but I'm not quite sure why it took me so long to read. Perhaps it was because I was very busy, but I can normally find room to read a book a lot quicker. Anyway, apart from that perplexing reason, in the end I gave this book 91 out of 100, which is a pretty decent rating, and certainly one of the higher rankings for all the books I've read and reviewed. From Bordeaux to South Africa. Next up, we have our mystery producer. And this is the second clue. The company produces a three-tier range of wines, premium, black label, and their top Babylons, Touraine. Among the great varieties include Chenin Blanc, Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, Pinotage, Cabernet Sauvignon, and Merlot. In addition, our mystery winery is committed to caring for the environment and even has an environmentalist within the company to help achieve higher levels of energy efficiency and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Just as an aside from my experience with them, they do produce a range of wines, some at the very entry level, which are okay, and some high levels. I've tried one of their wines quite recently called Albar. It's a red variety with all sorts of strange grapes in it. Very, very funky, though. It has a real slightly bretty, leathery note in it, as well as some of those green notes you get in a lot of South African Pinotage. But in this wine, it actually works quite well, with that greenness giving a bit of backbone and lifting the wine, and the leathery notes giving it a bit of complexity, as well as some nice fruit. So quite an interesting, funky wine. A lot of people don't like it. Some people really love it. Very interesting. Anyway, at least they're doing weird things with their wines. Well, I hope they're doing weird things. Okay, let's move on to the next thing, which is our interview. And we're going to be interviewing Ryan Opaz. He's a wine blogger. He runs, along with Robert McIntosh, the European Wine Bloggers Conference. And he's a pretty prolific Twitter. In fact, he fills up my Twitter stream quite a lot. Listen to what Ryan has to say about wine blogging. Hi, I'm here with Ryan Opaz from Katavino. How are you, Ryan?
I'm very good.
Excellent. No, I'm good. We're at the Bibendum tasting at the moment, and I thought I'd corner you because you are one of the big wine bloggy types, or at least you're very noisy on the blogosphere.
Noisy, yes, definitely. Whether I'm big, I'm tall, maybe that's it.
How tall are you?
6 foot.
No, about the same, yeah. Okay.
Not that big. Deep voice.
Yeah, no, it sounds good. It'll come through. Do you want to tell us quickly a bit about Katavino and what you guys do? Because you've got fingers in all sorts of strange pies.
Yep. No, Katavino was started in 2005 when me and my wife moved to Spain. I thought I was going to find a job in the wine industry. And with a little looking around, I couldn't find anything. And so started a wine blog. There was five or six of them that I knew of on the internet at that time. And I said, well, this looks interesting. So I started writing. And it was about a year into it, I realized, hey, somebody's reading this. And then we started having more people read it, and it kind of spiraled from there. But the premise is wines of Spain and Portugal. We live in Iberia in Spain, and mm-hmm. So we write about Iberian wines. And now we write about the culture, the food, travel, everything that goes with it.
Okay, so you've branched out. How many people read your blog?
We have about 20,000 uniques a month.
Oh, it's not too bad.
Yeah, no, it's not bad for a wine blog. It's, I guess we're ranked on some lists pretty high. I don't know how all these lists are kept, but we have a good readership, mainly US, UK. It's all in English, and we're always looking for new things to talk about.
And do you get revenue from that? Is it a business or is it?
sort of. This year we're going to start taking some advertising. So if anybody wants to advertise, let me know. But up until now, it's been a labor of love that basically, it was a promotional side for Katavino Marketing, where we write about social media marketing, those things, and work with clients to hopefully get them either online, using the internet, or this year, actually, I'll be doing quite a bit of speaking and going to do workshops and conferences. And so that's where we make the money. We kind of want both of them to make a little bit more money, but it's a learning process, you know. Blogging is a brand new world, especially in the wine world. You know, in tech, it's pretty well established. But in the wine world, there's still a lot of people who are seeing, what is this? Does it make sense? You know, some people asking silly questions like, is blogging writing?
I saw that yesterday. Yeah, Eat Like a Girl was talking about that.
And, you know, things like that just make me laugh. What a blog is, it's a publishing platform. And when the printing press came out, there were silly things that people did with that. But we didn't sit there and go, well, it's not writing. You know, because we write differently on a blog, that doesn't change that it is writing. It's a new way of communication.
Do you think the content or the context of what you say is different on a blog as opposed to maybe I don't know, what books, I suppose it must be compared to books in, say, the newspapers.
Yes and no. I mean, once again, it's a publishing content. So there are people who publish like a newspaper. There's people who publish, there's actually books that have been written online on blogs. There's people who just keep it as a journal. And a lot of time people apply that journal mentality of blogging to the whole scope of blogs and say, oh, well, there's people who journal on them, so therefore everybody is just simply writing down random thoughts. Well, no. I mean, Katavino, we're a long-form blog, I call it. Most of our pieces are well over 500 words. They're very researched. We go into detail about specifics. And, you know, we go check our sources, do the research. I don't have a journalist background, but that was common sense for me. If I'm going to do this, I have to do it right. I have to make sure I get the things right. And when I get something wrong, I correct it. I make sure I set the record straight.
Do you just change the blog, or do you publish that you've changed it?
We publish. Everything's open. Tell everybody what we're up to. If you hide anything in the blogging world, you might as well give up and go home. Somebody will find it out.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, a spelling mistake, maybe not. But if I say certain vintage is excellent because somebody said that and it wasn't true, okay, I'm going to make a correction and say why I corrected it. Mm-hmm. And that's important. It's very important. But it bugs me when people say blogging is, because there is no statement to end that. There is no blogging is. Blogging is so many different things.
What about tweeting? Because you're a prolific tweeter. Twitterer?
Yes. Yes.
And, between you and Gary Vaynerchuk, you pretty much fill up my tweet deck.
He must not be following many people then. Gary, maybe so. But tweeting is interesting. Tweeting, I tell people, my standard line when I give a talk is, you know what? When you start on Twitter, here's what you do. You go register your name. Make sure you own it. So I have Ryan Opaz. Twitter.com/RyanOpaz. If you don't know what Twitter is, go register your name. Then play with it for a day. Realize it's stupid and you don't like it. And go away for 6 months. You'll be back in 6 months. And you'll thank me because you registered your name and now you understand it. It doesn't make sense right away. And I can't intuitively teach how it works. But what comes out of it is very interesting. When you search terms, or for instance today at Bibendum, this event, there's a hashtag. There's a code that people are entering on every tweet, B times. When you take and you follow that and you look at what's coming out of it, you get some really interesting content around this event, both value for Bibendum and value for the people who are here. So I can follow it and find out where a good wine's being tasted or when lunch is being served, who knows. But afterwards, too, I can go back and say, huh, I didn't meet this person there, but he had some interesting things to say. So that's just one way Twitter works. It can also work as a blog. A lot of people don't have a email subscription anymore. What they actually have is somebody who takes and will do. They will take and use it as their news source. So they follow it for trends. People say the earthquake was a good example.
Yep.
When the earthquake started happening, boom! All of a sudden, you saw what was going on, where it was happening. Information's not always correct.
Balloon boy.
Balloon boy, another example. And there's a lot of those. And some of them are absolutely ridiculous. But nonetheless, if you want to, you can find out information fast. You can communicate an idea fast. And somebody back here was just asking, but I can't follow conversations, he was saying, asking somebody for advice on Twitter. And the thing is, Twitter is a place to start conversations or to find out what's being talked about. But if you walk into a room, I always give this analogy, you walk into a crowded bar, and you see all these conversations going on. You don't tell everybody, stop, tell me what you've been talking about, let me catch up. No, you get in, you follow the conversation, they may explain something. It's a very social thing. And when we look at it online, we go, this doesn't make sense. Yet we'll walk into a crowded room and start a conversation. And that's really what Twitter is in many ways. So it's many things to many people. I think it's very useful, though. I think it's very useful.
Who are the people you think, from a wine perspective, people should follow on Twitter?
I hope we give some value. Yep. Katavino and my personal account and my wife's account. But Jan says it was fun to see her get on. She actually asked us a couple questions in the beginning if this was a smart idea. And I said, most definitely. It makes you a real person. And for her, I think it's really been neat. People have connected with her in ways I don't think they ever connected with her before. Mm. And
Jancis Robinson.
Jancis Robinson, sorry. Other people in the wine world, you know, I find I don't follow as many people specifically for their wine knowledge so much as people who I respect as human beings. So like Len Endeavors, Len Devours, Len Thompson from New York. He writes about New York wines. I never have a chance to buy New York wines, but I follow him. I follow him because I do respect him as a wine writer, but I'm not following him for his New York wine stuff. I'm following him because I consider him a friend who I respect. And so in the wine world, I've gotten to know a lot of really cool people. And the interesting thing is, with wine, you want to drink what your friends drink. You will take and drink a wine, even if it's not 90 points, if your best friend tells you he likes it, because you're willing to taste it. Yeah. That's kind of how Twitter is for me. I don't care if it got a rating or something, but if Len turns to me and says, hey, I found something kind of cool, I'll probably look for it, because I respect him as a person, not as a wine person necessarily.
Yeah.
So I think some of the coolest people, even, who's the person? I'm going to totally forget and feel like a total jerk, but I have a couple of friends without blogs who just like wine. And they'll ask me a question once in a while or post what they got at the grocery store. I find that actually quite interesting.
Yeah.
Find who you're comfortable with. Yeah. You know, do a Twitter search for wine or wine in London and see who's talking about wine in London.
I find it quite interesting because I'm pretty awful with faces. You know, I meet people and then I'll forget their face almost as soon as I blink. You know, it's gone and awful. And I find things like Twitter quite good because the people I follow, I see their face coming up a lot. And every time I see it, like, I recognize you first time. I haven't seen you for 8 months, nine months. Yeah. And it was like, oh, Brian, I know who Brian is. Excellent.
Well, that's a problem. A lot of people think it's fun to put up a funny picture or whatever on their Twitter account.
Yeah.
Use your real face. I mean, you're branding yourself when you do this. And don't use some silly name. Use your name if you can. If it's a winery, you know, in fact, that's actually an interesting tip. Make sure you have your name, but also your winery's name. Because you're not your winery.
Yeah.
And there's times I want to talk to you and not to Bodega no sé qué. You know, I actually want to talk to the person.
Okay. Let's just touch on the European Bloggers Conference. I only heard about it quite late last year, maybe because I wasn't on Twitter at the time. And as soon as I got on it, I sort of started saying, oh, it was too late for me to head down there and have a look.
Yeah.
But what is it and what are you trying to achieve with it?
Well, it started 2 years ago. Robert McIntosh from Wine Conversation, my wife Gabriella and I said, actually, I wrote a post in, was it 2009, 2008, December of 2007, saying, this is ridiculous. We got to talk. All these bloggers have all these conversations going on. Nobody's really getting anywhere. And I realized the value of being offline to complement the online world. And so I turned to Robert and Gabrielle and said, should we do this? And they said, okay. And then we did something really silly. We announced that we were going to do a conference, not knowing what it takes to put the conference together. And the first one took place in Logroño in Spain, in Rioja. And was this 50 people, a huge success, a lot of fun. And it was really interesting what came out of it. It wasn't what we expected. We didn't know what to expect, to tell you the truth. But it was interesting seeing the crossing of cultures and the conversations that started because of that. We had 13 countries worth of people in that 50 people. So with the big success, we said we'll do it again. So being that we had good connections in Portugal, being Catavino, we decided on doing it in Lisbon. We had 150 people this time. Taking a conference up threefold is a big step, and there were some growing pains. But this time, we saw people taking it a lot more serious and looking at it as something that... I think there was a lot of people who came just being curious. Is this for real?
Yeah.
Is there really a niche like wine blogging that can support a conference like this? It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. And this year, I can't say exactly where it's going to be until maybe next week. But we have negotiations with a couple other countries. It will be outside of Iberia. And we're going to probably keep the numbers around 150 again. But this year, I think even more so, we want to really reach out to show people that wine bloggers are not just one thing, like I said. And that... the on-trade, off-trade, all the different sectors in the wine industry really need to figure out a way to deal with this whole concept of social media, the internet. In fact, this year probably is going to be more about wine technology than it will be about wine blogging specifically. I mean, wine blogging is kind of the lifeblood of social media in some ways. And I think the conversation will get a lot broader.
Okay. All right. I think we'll wrap it up there, Ryan. Thanks very much for your time.
Well, thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that blogging note. Ryan mentioned about the European Wine Bloggers Conference, and he hadn't finalised all the details when I interviewed him a couple of months ago. Since then, he has finalised everything. The conference is going to be held in Vienna, Austria, on the 22nd to the 24th of October. Starts on a Friday, finishes on a Sunday. So if you want to know more about it, you can go to their website, which is a nightmare to find. Just type in European Wine Bloggers Conference into Google and it'll come up pretty much straight away. Before we finish up though, how'd you get on with that mystery wine producer? It was, of course, Baxberg. Was a bit of a toughie. If you didn't get it, I don't blame you. They're a pretty big producer, but they're not that common. You know, you see their wines around in the pubs and clubs, etc., but not a well-known producer. As I said, I quite like their Alba, which is really bizarre wine. But before we finish up, next week we're going to be still talking with Ryan, and we're going to be talking with him about social media. And the last thing, obviously, is this week's quote, which I picked up from one of the sponsors of the European Wine Bloggers Conference site. It was supplied by the sponsor WineHub and appears to be their catchphrase. I searched for it and I couldn't find it anywhere except for associated with WineHub. And they say, small people talk about things, average people talk about ideas, and great people talk about wine. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.